speak a word of welcome to Dr. Cranford. I've been knowing Dr. Cranford for several years, longer than he's been knowing me. You fellows know how it is when you come out of seminary young and inexperienced and small, and you're in that little country church, and here is somebody who has already arrived in the very centers of learning and power, and who is filling so well one of the great pulpits in the state. Well, I wasn't so young as I would seem to indicate there, and Dr. Cranford just had so much wisdom and learning and ability that he rose faster than the average feller does. I wish that there was as much difference in his age and mine as my remarks would indicate, but it just isn't true. Dr. Cranford was pastor of one of the great churches in Virginia, the Second Baptist Church in Richmond. Shortly after that, he went to Washington to the Calvary Baptist Church and has been there for nearly 20 years. Dr. Cranford is a graduate of Bucknell. He is an excellent minister, as you will learn, a fine pastor, a good minister of Jesus Christ. And we welcome him to our pulpit with open heart and with open mind. And I know that you're going to want to get acquainted with Dr. Cranford, and he, of course, will want to know you. The week will go fast enough. The opportunities will be limited, but we hope that you will get to know him personally during this week. Dr. Cranford will bring us the message at the time in the order of the service. While the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake. But the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had ceased speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out in the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a great shoal of fish, and as their nets were breaking, they beckoned to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he was astonished, and all that were with him, at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. Henceforth you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him.
We're happy to be back in this place again. Once before most of you were born, I held some meetings when Dr. Blackburn was the minister. As I listened to this wonderful music, I was reminded that at that time, Dr. Hubert Petit was playing the organ for our meetings. Having known Edwin McNeil and Gordon fairly well, I was glad to meet another one of this great family that has contributed so much to the Baptist life of this state and the Christian life of America. I appreciated the very extravagant introduction Mr. Lyons gave me. Always makes me think a little bit of the rookie that faced Walter Johnson for the first time. Walter Johnson wound up and let go one of his famous fast ones, and the rookie literally didn't see the ball. He did hear a thud behind him, and he heard the umpire holler strike. The rookie turned around and said, "Did you see it?" The umpire said, "Yes." "What did you call it?" He said, "I called it a strike." The rookie shook his head and said, "Well, it sounded high to me." While some of the things he said were obviously high, they were appreciated nonetheless, and I am looking forward to renewing friendship with Ben during the week. The morning mists were rising from the Sea of Galilee, or as the Romans preferred to call it, the Lake of Gennesaret. The fishermen who had been out on the lake during the night had begun to come in, bring their boats into shore. Two of them already had docked. The men from the boats were washing the seaweed and other debris out of their nets. They were silent as they worked. They were not only tired, they were discouraged. They had fished all night and hadn't caught anything. And fishing for them was not just a sport, it was a means of livelihood if there were no fish in the nets. That meant less food on the table. While they were working, a crowd began to gather. This probably was nothing new. The people knew that early in the morning, Jesus preferred to come down to the lake shore to meditate. And so many of them, before the day's work demanded their attention and before the heat got too intensive, came down to the lake shore hoping that he would speak to them. On this particular morning, the crowd was so big, Jesus walked over to Simon and said, "Simon, would you be willing to just row out a few feet and let me address the people from your boat?" And I imagine Simon was quite pleased at the invitation. This would mean that he himself would get a measure of attention. And so he did as Jesus requested. He pushed out into the water. Jesus stepped into the boat. He rowed out a few feet and anchored. And Jesus addressed the people from the boat. When Jesus had finished speaking and the crowd began to disperse, Simon reached for his oars after he'd pulled in his anchor. When suddenly he heard Jesus say, "Launch out into the deep and let down your net for a draught of fish." And Simon turned surprised. He'd just come in from fishing all night. He hadn't caught a thing. And so he began to remonstrate with Jesus. He said, "Master, we've toiled all night and have caught nothing." But I imagine there was something about Jesus. If you looked in his eyes, it made you want to do his bidding. So Simon thought a second time and said, "Nevertheless, at thy word I will launch out and let down the net." And you know the result. The fish that were taken that morning were so many that they had to get John and James to come over with their boat to help. Even so, the fish were so heavy, the nets began to break, and if they had taken all the fish that were in the shoal that morning, it would have sunk the boats. There were so many. I've often imagined the things Simon might have said to Jesus when Jesus suddenly turned to him and said, "Launch out into the deep and let down your net." He might have said, "Who is he that he should tell me how to run my life and my business? I'm the fisherman in this boat. I've fished in this lake ever since I was old enough to hold an oar or a net. I know as well as any fisherman along this seacoast when and where the fish are apt to be running. Who is he anyhow that he thinks he can tell me how to run my life and my business?" And he might have refused to go. And if he had, he would have missed out on one of the greatest experiences of his life. Or he might have argued something like this. He might have said, "He has no right to ask this of me now. This is not a convenient time for me to do his bidding. He knows I'm tired. He knows I'm discouraged. He knows I've fished all night and have caught nothing. He knows I've just come in. There are no fish in the boat. He knows I want to get home and get breakfast and get some rest. I've got to come back this afternoon and try again. If I don't catch fish, my family doesn't eat. He has no right to ask this of me now. I just won't do it. And so he might have refused, and if he had, he would have missed out on the greatest catch he ever took. He might have tried to play it coy. He might have said, well, Master, you're certainly right about that. You don't catch fish in shallow water. I know that. Maybe a few little sunfish and some minnows swimming around under the boat. If you want to catch real fish, you've got to launch out into the deep water. You're right, Jesus. And I'm going to do what you say. That's exactly what I'm going to do later. And as he said the word later, he might have reached for the oars and began to pull for the shore. And if he had, he would have missed out on one of the greatest moments of his life, not only a moment in which he caught fish, but a moment in which there was revealed to him that the person who was in the boat with him was not just an ordinary person. A moment when there was a terrific self-exposure so that he fell at the feet of Jesus and said, depart from me, I'm a sinful man, O Lord. I'm not fit to be in the same boat with you. But a moment when his whole life had a new direction. From henceforth, you will be a fisher of men. Now, I don't have to point out to you that each of these reactions has its counterpart in life today. There are millions of people who refuse to launch out with Christ and the church simply because they refuse to give up the pleasures and the prestige of this world. Do you remember when the children of Israel were in the wilderness? They had been slaves in Egypt. Yes, they had had enough to eat. Usually they were given sufficient so that their stomachs were full at the end of the meal, but they never could eat their meal in peace. Always it was under the watchful eye of some taskmaster, and if they hadn't put out the number of bricks they should have put out that day, who knows but what somebody might come down and say, hurry up with your meal, you've got to get back making bricks. But sometimes our memories are awfully short. Sometimes that's a good thing. If we didn't remember some of the supposed slights we've received so long, we'd be happier. But sometimes we forget too soon. Here they were in the wilderness. The menu was rather restricted. Even if it was providentially provided, I suppose manna day in and day out got a little bit tiresome. The future was uncertain. Water was scarce. And finally, they turned to Moses in a querulous mood and said, isn't this what we told you back in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. It were better that we serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. As I say, their memories were awfully short. Better to eat a crust of bread in freedom than to have a meal knowing that any minute the taskmaster's lash might come down across your back. And yet there are millions of people not conscious they're enslaved by sin who are willing to say to Christ and the church, isn't this what we're saying to you? Let us alone. It would be better for us to die in our sins than that we should miss out on the pleasures and the prestige of the world. These people make two mistakes. The first mistake they make is to think that Christians never have any fun, and I've met a few Christians that have given that impression. But by and large, Christians are the happiest people on the face of the earth, for they have a satisfaction that goes deep and the kind of pleasures that are so wonderful that every time they are remembered, one collects a new dividend on them. I have a friend who once pawned his overcoat to hear Paderewski play the piano. He shivered for a few days. It took him a little time before he could get his overcoat back. But he said, I never once in my life regretted pawning that overcoat, because every time I think of the pleasure and the privilege of hearing the great Paderewski sit at the keyboard and play, he said, I thrill all over again. And the kind of pleasures Christians enjoy are pleasures that make you thrill all over again every time you remember them. They're not all clouded up with remorse and regret and disillusionment. The second mistake that people make like that are they think sin delivers what it promises, and it never does. It promises satisfaction, it delivers disillusionment and ultimately despair. It promises life, it delivers death. Did you ever stop to think the devil had no right to offer Jesus the kingdoms of this world? After all, the kingdoms of this world did not belong to him. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The devil was offering something he didn't own one square foot of it. If Jesus had bowed down and worshipped him, he would not only have lost his soul, he would have lost the world as well. That's why Paul says the devil comes wearing a false face that makes him look like an angel of light. On the surface, it looks awfully good. But when you get underneath, you discover how fiendish it is. There are some people who refuse to launch out with Christ and the church because they think it's going to cost them too much. Well, of course it costs to follow Jesus. It costs to do anything in this world. It even costs something just to follow the world. The world demands its price. It depends what we want to pay. I understand up in Yale, there is a professor who, if he is anything religiously, is an agnostic. And he takes great delight in pointing out the parallels between some of the teachings of Jesus and some of the statements of Hitler in Mein Kampf. Evidently, he makes no distinction between the moral qualities of the two men and of the movements they came to establish. And certainly, he makes no distinction between kinds of obedience, for there are two kinds of obedience. There is what Mrs. Wyman calls creative obedience, and then there is servile obedience, the Scrooge Hitler kind. The first is the obedience demanded by a dictator. The second is the obedience demanded by a father, and they're entirely different. The one is demanded so that the dictator can impose his mind on your mind. The kind of obedience required by a parent is guidance. When a parent insists that his son go to school, he is not doing it because he is mean. He knows this is the only way in which his son can grow. After all, we all have what Mrs. Wyman calls our have-tos. We have to obey the laws of health if we want to stay healthy. We have to obey the laws of the state if we want to stay out of trouble. We have to obey the moral laws if we want peace of mind. We all have to obey something. But it makes all the difference in the world where whether love or some other force is holding the reins. When Jesus said, "Take my yoke upon you," he wasn't offering a yoke to people who weren't bearing any. He was offering his yoke in exchange for the yoke they were already bearing, which was the yoke of sin and the yoke of obedience to the law, which was getting heavier and heavier the longer they wore it until finally it would crush the life out of them. The kind of a yoke he gave them was the kind that would make them stronger and grow more as sons of God. And it was a yoke that he would share with them. There's a wonderful verse back in Hosea. I like Moffat's translation. God says to Israel or Ephraim, "I taught thee how to walk. I led with a harness of love." That's it. Everyone wears a harness of obedience to something. But it makes a difference whether passion or ambition or love has hold of the reins. Passion, ambition can drive with a relentless hand. It can drive a man into despair. Love always drives with a considerate hand. We needn't think we're not going to have to obey anybody in this world. We have to decide what kind of obedience we want to give in order to get the results we want for our life. Certainly it costs to launch out in the deep at the call of Christ, but it's worth it. There are some people who fail to launch out with Christ in the church because they're conscious of their past failures. When President Harding was in the White House, he worshiped in our church, but he would never come to church on Communion Sunday because he said he was not worthy. And there were a lot of people who agreed with him. Well, who is? We don't ever come because we're worthy, but because he is. Not because we're good, but because he is. It's because we are unworthy, seeking his worthiness, that we come and partake of him. All of us are conscious of the times we said we were going to live up to our resolution to follow Christ, and then we failed him. During the Korean War, I was asked by the Air Force to go on a preaching mission to the Pacific, Japan, and Korea. And I remember as we got closer to Japan, the chaplains got a little bit more direct in talking to the boys because they realized that soon these boys would be out where there was a different kind of culture, where they would be anonymous, where they would be tempted as perhaps they would never be tempted back in their hometown. I don't ever remember being accosted by a woman on an American street. I hadn't been in Tokyo 15 minutes until I was approached by a young woman. One of our missionaries told me that by the time he left the train and got to the door of the station in Tokyo, he had been approached by 7 different women trying to proposition him. I've seen the girls standing around the places where the boys would come out from the airbase, hoping that they could pick up one of the boys who would have some money to spend. As many of you know, the chaplain delivers what he has called a character guidance lecture. This is mandatory. He has to deliver it. The boys have to come and hear it. And as we got to one of the islands quite close to Japan, I thought he did an excellent job in his character guidance lecture, telling them that they must remember not just what disease can do to the body, but what immorality can do to the soul as one thinks about his obligation to his family and his country and his God. I thought he did an excellent job, and I told him so. I said, "You did that better than I could. For one thing, you talked their language better than I could." And I'll never forget what the chaplain said. He said, "Cranny," calling me by nickname, he said, "I've managed to live the kind of life I talked to these boys about this morning, but they'll never know how hard it's been." And then in a moment of unusual candor, he turned and said, "There has hardly been a day of my life when I haven't had to fight to keep sex from playing too important a role in my thinking." Well, I said, "I've been a minister long enough to know you're not alone in that boat. But I also know you don't have to stay in it." I said, "Probably you've been too conscious of your past failures. You're coming at the thing the wrong way." And I mentioned this very passage about which we're thinking this morning. I said, "Don't start off the day by saying, 'I'm not going to think unworthy thoughts today,' because if you do, sure as shooting, you begin by thinking about them. You just come at the beginning of the day and offer God your net. And say, 'Oh God, here's my net. I've fished so often and I've caught nothing, but I'm going to try to launch out today for you. You just fill my net so full of thyself and of the needs of my fellow men, there won't be any room for some of the things I don't want there to get in. I know one thing. Whenever we do launch out with Christ and the church, there are some surprises. Some surprises in store for us. I have a little cottage up in Maine. It's not much of a cottage, but it's a magnificent view. Anyway, you come to the cottage, you come up a rise so that we're on the highest point of land in this whole county. Anyway, you look, you can see a view. You look to the east, you can almost see the ocean. You look to the west on a clear day, you can see Mount Washington, the highest mountain in New England, although it's 50 miles away. But the real view, you have to go around behind the cottage and look down the hill, and there are 3 lakes and the Ossipee Range going off into New Hampshire. It is almost a breathtaking view. Shortly after we began to go there, we invited a little congregation to come up to our hill for a watermelon feed and a hymn sing. I don't know which attracted the most, but they came. I remember the first year, the minister said, "We've never had an approach like this before. There may be only 10 or 15. But that afternoon he called up and said, "Get more watermelon. There are going to be at least 40 or 45. And there were 65 who came. But I remember one woman. I helped her out of the car. She was rather elderly, and she looked off to the east, and she said, "Why, that is a beautiful view, isn't it?" "Oh," I said, "you haven't seen anything yet." And I took her hand in my arm, and I helped her around the ledge down in back of the cottage, and just as we turned the back of the cottage and she began to see Raymond Pond and Crescent Lake and Sebago Lake and the Ossipee Range, I'll never forget what she did. She looked at you, and then she said, "I have lived within 20 miles of this view all my life and never knew it was here." And there are millions of people in the world today who live within a decision's distance of the joys of the Christian life, and they don't even know those joys and hopes are there because they've refused to go around behind whatever is keeping them from launching out with Christ. I never dreamed that night when I went to my church in Western Pennsylvania as a 13-year-old boy and went back to what we called our BYPU room. Sometimes we said it meant Baptist Young People's Union. Sometimes we said it meant Boost Your Pastor Up. But whatever it meant, there it was. And there was a pennant on the wall saying BYPU. There was an old pump organ, the kind you had to do with your feet, you know, as well as your hands. And I have one in my study now, partly because that old pump organ used to be there in the room where I accepted Christ. And my minister was there, and that night he said, "Clarence, why don't you give your heart to Christ and let me baptize you?" I'd been kind of dreading this. When the minister gave the invitation, my heart would start beating because I knew he was talking about me, and I kept putting it off. But that night I just sort of took a gulp and said, "All right." I didn't know all it would mean. I didn't know in what directions he'd want me to launch out. But I never guessed that because I said yes that night, that over and over again, he would fill my little net so full that I haven't been able to take it all into my one little life. Friends, I never would have met without the Christian Fellowship. Opportunities to speak in his name in Russia, in Japan. Not everyone can go across the seas to tell the story, but whatever he calls you to, there will be some surprises in store. And one day if we launch out with him, we'll stand on the shores of the sea of eternity, and he again will say, "Launch out with me and let down your net." And in all eternity, with all the help of all who are before the throne of God, we'll not be able to take in all the joys he has in store for us. I don't know where he's wanting you to launch out. Stewardship? Prayer life? Getting rid of something in your life that you know you should have given up a long time ago? Professing him as Savior? Changing your membership so that you can be a more worthy witness in the community? In whatever direction he's asking you to launch out this morning, launch out into the deep. Let down your net. He'll fill it. And if for some of you it does mean making a profession of faith or asking for membership in this church by profession of faith, by transfer of letter, or by statement of experience, will you come as the minister of this church is ready to greet you while we're singing our invitation hymn?